This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Closing arguments in the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin are expected on Monday. Yesterday, as prosecution and defense teams rested their cases, Chauvin, the man accused of killing George Floyd, spoke for the first time.
Have you made a decision today whether you intend to testify or whether you intend to invoke your Fifth Amendment privilege?
I will invoke my Fifth Amendment privilege today.
Chauvin pressed his knee into Floyd's neck last May. Cell phone video of Floyd's death sparked protests across the nation. Well, almost 30 years ago, another violent arrest, another video, and another trial ignited protests and felt like a possible turning point in American history. On March 3, 1991, after a high-speed chase, Los Angeles police pulled over a man named Rodney King. They brutally beat him. The moment was filmed by a nearby resident, and that video shocked the world. Four officers were eventually put on trial in Simi Valley, California.
This evidence will show that whatever Rodney King was, or whatever he did, it did not justify what you saw on that videotape.
Well, today we're going to talk about the similarities and differences between these two moments. Across decades, distance, technology, and social reckonings, what do the trials reveal about what has and has not changed in America? We'll begin with the story of a woman whose life was transformed that night in 1991, the night LAPD assaulted Rodney King.
It's part of my life. It's something that I will never, ever be able to escape from. It's something that was in my 12th grade history book, and it's something that will be part of history to my children as well.
This is Laura King. She is Rodney King's daughter. Laura was 7 years old in 1991, and to this day, she remembers exactly where she was when she first saw images of police beating her father in the video that shocked the world.
I was watching the news in Montclair, California.
Dramatic videotape obtained by Channel 5 News.
Me and my sister were playing.
Shows what appears to be a group of LAPD officers beating a suspect.
And all of a sudden, I look on the screen and they mention the name.
Prior to his release from jail last night, 25-year-old Rodney King showed his injuries to reporters.
And I'm like, he has the same name as my dad. What a coincidence, you know? And then as I looked around and looked at my family's reaction, I put two and two together, like, wait, what's going on? And then my mom yelled, that's Rodney.
In our review, we find that the officers struck him with batons between 53 and 56 times.
And my heart shattered, because right before she said that, I thought to myself, whoever this human is, there's no way they can live through that.
The bruises, broken legs, and the scars from the stun gun which jolted him with 50,000 volt shocks.
I could say after the first three good licks with one, you know, one with that, with the shocker, and the next with the billy club across the face. I was scared for my life.
And I just think about often, like, and we all been in t-shirts and we've worked out, so we know how this is when you work out and your shirt's like sweaty. Now imagine that, but being that your own blood, and you're constantly being tased and you're getting yelled at to be still.
King claims, and several witnesses support him, that he never resisted.
I've never been tased, but I got whoopings as a kid. And it's like, my mom would be like, be still. Well, you're whooping me. How am I going to be still? Because my nerves are going to have a reaction.
I kneeled to my knees, spread my hands out, and hit the ground as slow as I could. Because I didn't want to make any, you know, stupid moves. Because I'm already wondering, like, I mean, why are these guys, why are they drawing down on me?
And I can't run from that videotape. That's something that I can't escape from, because that comes out in regular conversation. I could be anywhere. And so that's the part that bothers me, to actually watch a human being crawl for his life, let alone it just so happened to be my father.
Against a growing national furor over last weekend's police beating of an unarmed black motorist, Los Angeles Police Chief Daryl Gates said today that all 14 officers involved will be disciplined, and that three will face criminal charges.
The officers, we believe, used excessive force in taking him into custody.
some of the egos that the officers, not all of them, because some of them I felt like they were remorseful, but I felt like a few of them were a little ego-based, and it was like, come on, you know, we didn't do anything wrong kind of thing. And for a child to watch that, it's kind of heartbreaking, because we live in a world that says, you know, all men are created equal. But in fact, we have to ask ourselves, are they? Are they created equal, or are we just saying that just to make people feel better? Because in my eyes, they were conducting themselves like nothing was wrong.
The evidence is new, it's dramatic, and it's devastating to those Los Angeles police officers involved in the March 3rd beating of that black motorist. The incident, as you've no doubt seen, was videotaped by a private citizen.
My grandfather that I lived with was a Los Angeles sheriff. And he was right and right, wrong was wrong type of person. He didn't say, well, he's black, give him a break, or he's white, you know, he's gonna. He didn't think like that. So for me, it was a little hard to watch because it wasn't making sense to me.
The police communications released today included regular radio transmissions as well as computer messages between police cars. One of the two officers who wielded batons that evening relayed a message after the arrest to another car saying, quote, sounds almost as exciting as our last call. It was right out of Gorillas in the Mist. Response, ha ha.
And I have to question myself, dang, how many Rodney Kings have they done this to? How many that didn't get videotaped?
Car one again. Oops, I haven't beaten anyone this bad in a long time. Car two responds, oh no, not again. I thought you agreed to chill out for a while.
You know, even though my dad lived through the incident, 90% of him died that night. You know, people look like, well, at least he lived. No, he didn't, actually. He was never the same. He lived with excruciating pain for the rest of his life, as well as a fractured skull. So then you're forced to live with this name, Rodney King, and of course, get a job. Well, who could get a job? Because everybody knows that name. Everybody knows that name. I always try to be like a spark of light around my dad because I knew he was dealing with a lot all the time. So I never personally talked about the incident. I think the first time I talked about the incident with him was when he was on Celebrity Rehab. And Dr. Drew asked, are you guys embarrassed of your dad? And I'm like, no way. Like, what? And my dad looked like he was in shock, like he was surprised that we weren't. And I'm like, absolutely not. I feel like we failed my dad. We failed my father as a human being. For the simple fact that he should have been given mental health for the rest of his life, as well as any other African-American, or white, or black, or Asian, or fat, skinny, blue, green person that's been beaten by the police. They should be given mental health for the rest of their life. This is not a temporary Band-Aid. They will never be the same. Of course, my father's beating is everywhere on social media, but at the time, it was just a videotape that they would show over and over. In this case, George Floyd's case, it's everywhere. It's on Instagram, it's on Facebook, it's on Google, it's on YouTube. My first thoughts were, I wonder, does he have children? I wonder how old they are. And I thought to myself, like, his kids, they have to live the rest of their life watching their dad being murdered over and over and over again. And I was watching the video thinking, I wonder if my dad's still living. Well, there was a little life moving because he was still scrambling for his life. So there was still movement. But in their case, they see him. He knew that it was over. That's why he called for his mother, who was deceased. Most people that are getting ready to take their last breath, they call for a person that's dead already. And to me, it saddens me that that man knew he was dying because he said it over and over. I'm out of here. I'm out of here, which means I'm dying. He still didn't get up. And for me, it's like, it's really sad because he never got up. He never got up and he died. And they just rolled him over. They rolled him over and said that, you know, he took opiums and da-da-da. But the truth is, it doesn't matter what he took. A black man's life is not a state of emergency around here. It's just another birth certificate and death certificate. That's it. I feel like America has learned hashtags. That's basically it. But no, honestly, I'm going to tell you this. I am hopeful because I've seen something last year that I've never seen before. And that's different nationalities being fed up. That's different nationalities speaking up like, hey, no. This is wrong. These people don't deserve this. And that gives me hope.
Laura King is the daughter of the late Rodney King. She's also CEO of the Rodney King Foundation. King died in June 2012. Earlier that same year, he spoke with Oprah, the last interview before his death.
It's not a day that goes by that I don't forget the beating, but it's not in a negative way like it used to be. It has turned into a positive way. It's part of history now. I wouldn't change the beating either, because if it didn't happen to me, then it would be a slower process of people being able to get along.
Well, in 1992, a jury did acquit all four Los Angeles police officers charged with assaulting King. In 1994, King filed a civil suit against the city and won. King's lawyer, civil rights attorney John Burris, said in a press conference at the time that he hoped the victory could bring change.
Once there's a finding of liability on punitive liability component, that we would achieve a significant result and would have a strong impact nationwide on how police officers treat each other, treat citizens, and on how on the responsibilities that citizens, that districts have and cities have to monitor the conduct of their police department.
That's John Burris in 1994. He joins us to talk about America in 2021 when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today we're talking about what has and has not changed in America between 1991 and the brutal police beating of Rodney King in Los Angeles, and 2021 and the trial of former police officer Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis. I'm joined now by John Burris. He's a civil rights attorney, and he represented Rodney King in his civil lawsuit against the LAPD in 1994, and he joins us from Oakland, California. John Burris, welcome to On Point.
Good to be with you.
So,
now, I've been involved in these cases steadily since 1994 up until the present time, and I must admit there have been significant changes in public awareness of the issues of police brutality and police misconduct and how the police treat the African-American community. That's been brought about largely as a consequence of various litigations that have taken place, more public awareness on the part of political leaders, but more importantly, the advent of the cell phone and video camera. And Rodney King was a sea change for the world when that video camera was set forth. There had not been any kind of public display about police misconduct ever before on a real level, even though the African-American community certainly was aware of it, and certainly I was involved in litigation around that. But I'll tell you, that video had a tremendous impact. But since then, in the numerous cases that exist around the country, what makes a big difference is there's been a cell phone or a body cam video that allows people to really see firsthand what it takes place in some of the urban communities. Mm. Although I do believe there's been a lot of progress made at various points in time during this last 30 years, when the Obama administration and somewhat part of the Bush administration, they really put forth a lot of pattern and practice litigation. And in that way, they affected a lot of different departments and how to make adjustments and reforms. And that was working pretty well during those governmental periods, except that when the Trump period administration came along, they essentially did away with all of it. Mm-hmm. And that made it extraordinarily difficult.
Well, so, Mr. Burris, if I may, I'd like to actually discuss in detail with you as much as we can about that exact sweep of history that you just described to us. So I'd like to slow down a little bit and take it piece by piece and really learn from, you know, from your expertise. So first of all, let's spend another minute on video evidence of police brutality. So first of all, this is about to play a moment from the trial of Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis. And this is Prosecutor Jerry Blackwell speaking to jurors about the video, that cell phone video of George Floyd's death. And this is from the first day of the Chauvin trial.
And if I had to give this part of the evidence, you're going to see a name, I would tell you that you can believe your eyes. That it's a homicide, it's murder. You can believe your eyes.
So, John Burris, you talked about the fact that one of the biggest differences is the ubiquity now of body-worn camera videos or cell phone videos in incidents of police violence. I'd like you to help us remember what a shock it was in 1991 when that video was taken of the officers beating Mr. King, because obviously that kind of police violence had been going on. It just wasn't so instantly available to eyes around the world. Can you remind us, like, how profound that video really was?
It was more profound. It was shocking, literally shocking, because people had not seen that level of brutality. And I will tell you, there was a significant aspect of the population rejected it. Basically by saying it only happened as a consequence of Rodney King himself. It was the first form of victim shaming, if you will, that he brought it upon himself. It was his failure to comply. And I recall when I'm doing this case, it was very difficult for people to appreciate that any movement Rodney King was making at the time was a function of his reaction to having been hit 56 times. Mm-hmm. And the population it was hard to accept it because it was so brutal. And you couldn't imagine people would beat someone that way, and particularly a police officer. So it was an eye-opener around the world, if you will. I was visited some African countries later on in Europe, and they all talked about how Rodney King. And so it was a major blow against the United States in terms of geopolitical politics. But certainly in the local communities, we were shocked. And I'll tell you that that after the verdict came in and the officers were found not guilty, that was even worse because people couldn't imagine how an officer could beat someone the way they beat Rodney King and not be held accountable. And so that's where we were at that time. And it was way beyond normal comprehension. Now, for me, I had been involved in police misconduct cases like that. I knew about that level of brutality, so I wasn't totally surprised at it. I was just shocked to see it on video camera. And I also knew it was a sea change that was going to occur. Because if you had cameras like this to show police brutality, there's going to be another public awareness and a public awakening, mm-hmm. which ultimately did happen over a period of time.
Mm-hmm. You know, so the video was there. It existed. And then as you heard in the previous segment, in the days after the video was first released, LAPD did release police communications from that night as well. There seemed to be quite a bit of evidence mounting up well before the case went to trial the next year in 1992. And just to remind folks, though, what happened was four officers were charged. They all ended up being acquitted. And I want to understand from you, Mr. Burris, a couple of the reasons why that happened. First of all, the trial wasn't held in Los Angeles specifically, right? It was moved to Simi Valley. Can you talk about that?
That was important. The most important decision that was made. And that was good work on the part of the defense counsel to get the case out of L.A. County. If it had stayed in L.A. County, I'm sure the officers probably would have been convicted. But essentially it was moved to a bedroom community where police officers live in Simi Valley. And that's the other part of this. There's so much of this is about cultural lifestyles. What's your commitment? What's your appreciation? And so in a place like Simi Valley, it was a police culture. And so, therefore, it was a place where the community there was supportive of the police.
It didn't matter what they did. They were supportive of the police, where other communities would be just the opposite. There are certain parts of central L.A., if you they were tried there, they would have easily been found guilty because those jurors would have had experience in dealing with LAPD in different sorts of ways, and they understood that the cops did not treat people in a most honorable way. So the location mm-hmm. was really the significant point.
So that's that is a difference then between 1992 and 2021, because the trial Absolutely. Of Derek Chauvin is going on in Minneapolis.
The important part to me is what I like about the trial here today is that it is racially cultural mixed, which did not happen in Simi Valley. So here you have, even though it's a city that has very small minority population, it does have a cross-section of minorities on that jury. That gives some more credibility and to the jury itself. And it, you know, breaks away from the sense that it was an all-white jury that was supportive of the police or vice versa. So the jury composition, and I think each side worked very hard to do that because they each left on some people, I think, that under circumstances in other cases they would have excised them and got rid of them. But I think there was a real effort to make sure that there was a cross section of the community there, and for purposes, in many ways, for the juror decision to be accepted mm-hmm. By having this cross section of ethnic jurors on that panel.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk for a minute or two about how Mr. King was characterized in the trial in 1992. Now, again, it wasn't his trial, right? It was four LAPD officers who were on trial. And yet Rodney King's own character was essentially, in a sense, put on the stand. I mean, so here's a moment from again, the 1992 trial where Michael Stone, defense attorney for one of the LAPD officers, Lawrence Powell, he talks about Rodney King.
Duty did not require Officer Powell to end up toes up on a slab in a morgue. They don't get paid to roll around in the dirt with the likes of Rodney Glenn King.
John Burris, talk about that. How much was him? What was Mr. King himself on trial?
Well, clearly he was profiled first as ex-convict. Secondly, as a big black man, a brute, if you will, and that essentially it was he himself that caused this entire escapade to occur, because he was this big African-American man that people were afraid of. It reminded me of a statement that they had made the night before, shortly thereafter, about gorillas in the mist. That certainly was the undertones of how that case was tried, and it was appealed to the prospective jurors out there in Simi Valley, which was all white. So it was purely unadulterated, a racial bias presentation, and it appealed to the baseness of racial ethnic of the community, and depicted him. And it wasn't just for the trial itself, but it was for the public consumption nationwide, worldwide, that there was this big dude, this big brute guy, that was non-compliant, and he had to be beaten into submission in order to get compliance. So that's what it was depicted. He was not human. He was somehow in a different plane, and the humanness was taken away from him.
Well, this is one way in which that video was actually used by the defense to defend the officer's actions, right? I mean, they even did sort of a moment-by-moment analysis of every one of Rodney King's movements and said, well, this is the justification for why the officers beat him with clubs more than 50 times. I mean, here's a moment that describes that. This is LAPD veteran Charles Duke Jr. He testified for the defense again in 1992, and he dissected the tape to identify King's movements. And here's that moment.
He's in a rising position. He has this leg is cocked. He's up on his knees, or up on his elbows, in a rising position.
All right, so you're saying based upon all that has happened up to date with regard to this scenario, you think it would be appropriate to hit him?
Yes, I do, because once an officer is attacked, to allow the suspect to rise to his feet, you allow the potential for escalating the situation into a deadly force mode.
That's LAPD veteran Charles Duke testifying for the defense in 1992. John Burris, can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I think that what was the horribleness to me was he had to be beaten into submission, and that the video was used in ways to slow it down so that every little move he made, even though the reaction to being hit, but when he was reacting to being hit by one of the batons, any movement that he made was then interpreted as an aggressive act toward the police. And it was a horrible thing that was being done. And ultimately, when we had to deal with our civil trial, there clearly was that same effort was being made. And so the video, I want you to understand, is not a panacea. It's a two, it can be a two-edged sword, depending on how it's used. And in that particular case, even though you had all of this brutality that was taking place, it was used in such a way to show that actually Rodney King was the aggressor, because he failed to submit and reacted to every time he was being hit. That's an unfortunate aspect of how that videotape was used. Right. And I would say that, you know, it's used that way in a lot of different cases as well. The videotape in and of itself, it can be very positive, but can also be misused and misdirected and misinterpreted by counsel.
Right. Now, do I have this right that was it in the civil trial where you got an acoustics expert to come in to really try to listen to what the Absolutely. What the officers were saying as they were beating Mr. King?
Absolutely.
So tell me about that.
Yeah. So during the course of the trial, during the course of the preparation, I could hear faintly words like "nigger, stay down," "nigger, stay down," but you couldn't hear it. So what I did, I found an auto technician, and not an expert, who was in down in Los Alamos, down in New Mexico, and he came to court, and he was able to amplify those words that were being said, and so everyone could then hear that what was being said was "nigger, stay down, nigger, stay down," and it made a huge difference in the case, because then all of a sudden it wasn't just a beating case; it had racial overtones, and I think that was important. Then that was not done in the criminal case. It was something we came up with in the civil case that I think made a big difference in people's perception that it wasn't just a beating per se; it really was a racially overtoned beating that these officers were involved in.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Burris, I have to say we are broadcasting this live right now, and under other circumstances, we would definitely be bleeping out the N-word because of its destructive power. But in this case, again, we're live, and I completely understand that hearing the destructiveness of that word in this context actually matters to deepen our understanding of what we're talking about here. So I just wanted to let listeners know that. But there's so much more to talk about. There's one more specific thing about maybe some parallels between what happened in the first trial in 1992 and the trial of Derek Chauvin right now in 2021. And I want to talk again about how drugs were introduced as a factor in the case. So here is defense attorney for former LAPD officer Daryl Munger. The defense attorney represented Stacey Kuhn, and he argued that the officers thought that Rodney King was high on PCP.
Rodney King displayed the objective symptoms of being under the influence of something. And Sergeant Kuhn will tell you, I knew he was under the influence of something. I saw a blank stare in his face. I saw watery eyes. I saw perspiration. I saw that he swayed. I saw that he was slow to follow the commands of the officers. I saw him looking through me.
And Billy Broad, a use of force expert in the current trial of Derek Chauvin, was called in as a defense witness. And here's what he said.
People on the influence of drugs may not be hearing what you're trying to ask them to do. They may not understand. They may have erratic behavior. They may have they don't feel pain. So techniques you would normally use to make somebody comply, they're not feeling. They may have superhuman strength, or they may have an ability to go from compliant to extreme non-compliance in a heartbeat.
John Burris, we have 30 seconds before we have to take our next break here, but this seems to be a constant in many police violence cases. It hasn't, the use of this in the defense hasn't changed much.
Absolutely. And you know, in Rodney King's case, it really was that he was on PCP, and therefore he had this superhuman strength, and which was, on balance, he was being beaten so badly, everything he was doing was reaction to it. None of what they believed to be true was a justification for the beating that they gave him. And we see in the Chauvin case the same thing, that they want to use the drugs as a defense to justify the use of force, which in my view is fundamentally wrong.
But well, Mr. Burris, forgive me for interrupting, but we've just got to take that quick break here. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the 1991 police beating of Rodney King and the trial of four LAPD officers that happened the next year in 1992, and looking to see what has and has not changed in America across the almost three decades since then, as the nation watches the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin now. I'm joined today by John Burris. He represented Rodney King in King's civil lawsuit against the LAPD in 1994, and he joins us from Oakland, California. And in a moment, we'll hear from a friend of George Floyd as well. But John Burris, earlier in the show, I played a moment from a press conference that you gave in 1994, and I want to play it again because, to me, there's the sound of hope and maybe even guarded optimism in your voice in 94, and I want to see if you still feel the same way. But here's what you said back in 94.
Once there's a finding of liability on punitive liability component, that we would achieve a significant result and would have a strong impact nationwide on how police officers treat each other, treat citizens, and on how on the responsibilities that citizens, that districts have and cities have to monitor the conduct of their police department.
So, Mr. Burris, Rodney King and you won that civil case, but how does the 1994 John Burris' statement fall on the 2021 John Burris hearing it now? Did you get the change that you had hoped for?
Well, I will say that it is true that I expressed real optimism during that period of time, cautiously so. And I still feel that way. I do believe in the arc of history is long, but it ultimately bends toward justice, as Dr. King said. And I also believe that what I am and others were just... it is important for all of us to continue to move the social justice arc in a positive way. But there are setbacks along the way. It's a huge country, and there's deep, deep history here. You know, the history of the police in the African-American community goes way back to slavery. And I think the remnants of the attitudes of the general of the police toward African-American community is somewhat similar to that, but not all. Not all. There are a lot of African-American officers who I think and leaders in departments. And I've been involved in a case called the Riders up in Oakland, where we got involved in a review of the entire department through a pattern and practice. And I've seen that in other departments. So I think it's a function of the political leadership of a particular town, and yet holding officers accountable and having visibleness that they can see. I see a lot of that happening. Now, unfortunately, we do have individual acts that take place that create a setback on this issue that happened with that African-American soldier. And Virginia the other day. Well, I've had three or four cases recently where bad things have happened to people. But I also think the public response to those is a lot different now than it was 30 years ago. The general population in many ways are positive in their response. And the rallies that happened from George Floyd was amazing to me. I really thought that it was an opportunity for a momentum to take place, for a movement to occur. And in many ways, it has happened in some communities. Not perfect, and I don't expect it to be perfect. But I'm optimistic still that you have to keep plugging away at these issues. And people of goodwill over time can make a difference. Individual communities. Of course, there'll always be setbacks, but at the same time, you have to be positive, which I am, right, and try to be just about all the time.
Well, John Burris, if you can just stand by for a moment, I want to now bring into the conversation Vaughn Dickerson. He joins us from Houston, Texas. He grew up with George Floyd in Houston, and he's co-founder of 88 Chump, a nonprofit social activism organization. Vaughn Dickerson, welcome to On Point.
Good morning, everyone.
Now, I understand that you were in high school with George Floyd, the same year that Rodney King was beaten by LAPD, and that video went, that 1991 video went around the world. Do you remember seeing that in high school?
Of course, it was world breaking news, especially for everyone quote unquote who grew up in the ghetto or what they call the hood.
And what do you remember thinking, you and your friends? What did you talk? How did you talk about what you saw in the video?
First of all, it was unbelievable to see those officers literally, quote unquote, beat a man to death while he was still alive. And we were kids at the time, so it was hard for us to just digest the severity of what was going on. But we knew what was going on because it was happening right in the inner city of Houston, Texas also. And like I always say, pretty much in all the ghettos all over the world. So it was just heartbreaking to see it happen to him. And he's not resisting officers or anything. He's trying to protect himself from getting beat worse than he is getting beaten.
Mm-hmm. And when the verdict came down in that criminal trial of the four LAPD officers and they were all acquitted, how did that land with you and George Floyd and your classmates?
It was no surprise. I mean, everybody knew that they were guilty because, as we were always taught when we played sports, the video doesn't lie. And we knew that they were guilty, but we knew that in the court of law there, that back then and even till this day, there hasn't been no accountabilities for police officers' actions against individuals inside the inner city. So we knew that it was a strong possibility chance, 99%, that they weren't going to get found guilty because of their skin color.
Mm-hmm. You were friends with George Floyd. Can I ask if you tell us a little bit about him, about what your friendship was like growing up? Yeah.
I was best friends, one of George Floyd's best friends. We grew up as kids, middle school, high school, until after we both played ball together, football and basketball. We both were blue chippers in football and basketball, and that started varsity for 3 years. We both got moved up to varsity football and varsity basketball our freshman years. It was days I'd go to his mom's house, she'll feed us. It was days his mom couldn't provide, they'll come to my mom's house, eat, sleep, everything. We could do almost everything together but wear each other's clothes because he was so big. But we played Little League ball together after school. Me and some more guys, we probably spent more time with George than his own family did because we were that close-knitted.
Mm. Have you been watching? Go ahead. Sorry.
I'm sorry. He was a large individual. When we were in high school, he was 6'6", dunking a basketball. But he was one of the most friendliest individuals you would ever meet. He was a peacemaker. And I tell guys all the time, I said, man, in all my time of knowing Perry, man, he never had a fight. We were all the ones always fighting. He never fought. Mm-hmm. So that explains a lot about his character, of whom he was. He was a jokester. Everywhere you go, he just cracked jokes. He was a friendly person, and everybody loved him.
Yeah. Have you been watching the trial?
Sporadically, I've been watching it, and because I understand the system and how it works. And as was just stated, they're using pretty much some of the same tactics, trying to say drugs in the system and things of this nature, things they used 30 years ago. And again, the video doesn't lie. And it's sad to see that we, the citizens of America, and the system that's supposed to protect and serve, doesn't really want to hold no officer accountable for any killing of any black man or woman here in America. And it's just sad right now.
Mm-hmm. And we have been talking with Mr. Burris, as you've been hearing, about some of the really striking similarities between the 1992 Los Angeles case and what we're hearing in the trial in Minneapolis now. There are also some really, really big differences. And John Burris, I want to turn to you on this, because one of the biggest differences is that the current police chief of the Minneapolis Police Department testified against Derek Chauvin in this current trial. So here's a moment from that. Police Chief Medaria Arredondo on day 6 of the trial.
When Mr. Floyd was no longer responsive and even motionless, to continue to apply that level of force to a person proned out, handcuffed behind their back, that in no way, shape, or form is anything that is by policy, it is not part of our training, and it is certainly not part of our ethics or our values.
John Burris, it is exceedingly rare, if not unheard of a sitting police chief to testify against their own officers. But it seems like the opposite end of the universe from how Daryl Gates, who was then LAPD's chief, handled the case around his four officers in 1992. Do you want to talk about that?
Absolutely. Daryl Gates, although he authorized the officers to be fired, he never really came to court or took a position that the officers had violated policy. One of the things that was very notable about that is that LAPD officers testified that the beating was within policy, which is contrary to what we have in George Floyd's case here, Chauvin's case, where officers came from the department and said it was outside of policy. And that's a huge difference. And it matters, it seems to me, in terms of credibility for the department, that they are willing to acknowledge when officers get out of lines and they violate the law, and as opposed to, as they say, sticking behind the code of silence that existed. So this was remarkable, truly remarkable for that to occur. And and we'll see whether or not it mattered to the jury itself, because you do have other officers, like this police practice person says, that it was within policy. And this is the dichotomy that we fight in every case, is that there are officers who will stick by a police officer no matter what, no matter what they did, or even that it's in the face of common sense and violation of the law. So there's a long ways to go in that area. But certainly it relates to Chauvin's case and Rodney King's case. There was that huge difference in terms of law enforcement's participation.
Yeah. You know, in the moments and days right after the 1992 trial of those Los Angeles police officers, there was this sense that perhaps this could be a turning point in American history. But many people look back and say, well, it could have been, but perhaps that turning point was delayed because of the response that happened after the not guilty verdicts came down. There were riots in Los Angeles, and even Rodney King himself tried to appeal to protesters. And here's what he said:
I just want to say, you know, can we all get along? Can we get along? Can we stop making it horrible for the older people and the kids?
That was Rodney King in 1992. Von Dickerson, what are you thinking about what might happen in the moments after a verdict, whatever it might be, is handed down in the Chauvin trial?
Well, we know for sure that not if anything happens, quote unquote, if it doesn't go in a favorable way for Mr. Charbonneau getting found guilty and convicted and get a harsh sentencing for what he did, that there will be protests in the streets, but it'll be peaceful protests. We know the Minnesota National Guard will be out there and everything. They will have more police involvement there than they did at the Capitol. So we know because it's colored people there. So we know, and they tend to think that when there's a lot of colored people that, quote unquote, we don't know how to act. So again, it will be peaceful protests no matter what, because as you just saw, another unarmed black man was just killed about 10 miles away from where they're actually having the trial. Mm-hmm. And my thing is that you see people marching and protesting, and we're putting Black Lives Matter and murals all over the United States of America and over the world. Those are the voices of the unheard. And because if we were being heard, we wouldn't have to do that. And as Mr. King's daughter stated, it's sad because no one knew Perry's mother. We called him Perry, that Floyd's mother had passed away. We knew. Then nobody else knew. The world found out later. Mm. So it was really, really heartbreaking for me to see him call for his mother, Miss Sissy, and knowing that he couldn't help himself. And he knew what was going on. He knew not to resist the officer. He wasn't resisting. He complied in every way possible. And it's sad to see them taint him and put him on trial and trying to say it was drugs and trying to say it was a fake $20 bill and now it's the emissions from the car. And it's just sad that there's no accountability. And I like to thank the Minnesota police chief for coming in, because he's standing up for what's right, and he took an oath and he's taking accountability. So that's a beautiful thing compared to the Rodney King case, where they gave them a slap on the wrist, suspended them or whatever they did, and, you know, et cetera. But right here, now, back then they had a policy where it was a code of silence. Now you have a policy that's accountability, because it's not just people of color marching. You have Caucasians, you have Asians, you have Chinese, Vietnamese, you have Mexican Americans, you have everybody that's marching, and it's a younger generation, and they want change.
Right.
You know, racism is something that's taught in the home. It's not something you wake up and say, I'm a hater black man or a black woman. It's something that your parents and grandparents have taught you guys since slavery days and told you guys that you were better than us. And that's why it's been passed on from generation to generation.
Yeah. You know, we just got a minute left, and I've heard a note of hope from both of you here. So, John Burris, I have one last question for you. We literally just got about 30 seconds. You've been doing this for decades, though. You want to get to a time where you don't have to try cases like this anymore, don't you? We all do.
Well, I'm, you know, when I think through it, not hearing the question totally, I think through it that I'm hopeful that the case itself, if it's presented out where it looks like a fair evidence was presented and decision was made, that the general public will accept it. I am worried, though, that if not, that we could have another firestorm like we've had, not at other times. Rodney King was much more of an eruption first time out of the box. But since then, we've had other cases that people understand, and the system doesn't always work perfectly. So I'm hopeful that the verdict comes out and
right.
You have some due consideration, real consideration for the facts of what happened.
Well, John Burris represented Rodney King in his civil lawsuit in 1994. Mr. Burris, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. Good to be with you.
And Vaughn Dickerson, friend of George Floyd and co-founder of 88 Chump, thank you so much as well. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.